From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In 1938, the essayist E.B. White predicted that television would be a major test of the modern world. "We shall discover," wrote White, "either a new and unbearable disturbance of the general peace or a saving radiance in the sky." What's become of White's belief about television? Are broadcasters today socially responsible? In the first of two discussions about media and society, Soundings put that question to three recent visitors at the National Humanities Center: Frank Stanton, Bruce Christensen, and Raymond Carroll. Frank Stanton is president emeritus of CBS, which he joined in the early days of American broadcasting. Among his current duties, Dr. Stanton serves as a trustee of the National Humanities Center. Bruce Christensen is the president of the Public Broadcasting Service. Raymond Carroll is a professor in the School of Communication at the University of Alabama, where he serves as editor of Feedback, the publication of the Broadcast Education Association. Gentlemen, let's begin our conversation about broadcasting and social responsibility. Some people would say that that's a contradiction in terms, and I want to probe that question. Is it, in fact, a contradiction? Let's begin by talking about a very broad social concept, stewardship. Frank Stanton, do you think that broadcasters view the business they're in as a stewardship? Are they aware of the social elements in broadcasting? Do they think that they're socially responsible?
By and large, I think they do. There are some who are totally bottom line oriented, and I think those are the ones who've come into the industry later. I'm absolutely certain that in the early days, the commercial broadcaster, and this is true for all broadcasters, I think, take their responsibility seriously. They have, I think, or at least I used to think in terms of three broad areas of responsibility as programming was concerned. There are other responsibilities, but certainly from the programming point of view, I thought we were a mass medium, and therefore we had to have a mixture of entertainment and news and, if you will, public affairs in the broadest sense of the word. Don't ask me to define these things too precisely because they blur. There is education and entertainment, and there is information and education. I mean, there is information and entertainment. But those are the three broad things. I thought we also had a responsibility as broadcasters to develop new art forms. That's becoming more difficult as the medium, or the media, if you look at it as a multiple medium operation, as we become more mature, there are fewer things that are still available in the way of forms that can be tried.
Bruce Christensen, do you agree with what Frank Stanton is saying? Speaking from the standpoint of the non-commercial public broadcasting, do you see yourself as somehow the holder of a more serious public trust than the commercial broadcasters?
No, I think Frank has outlined well the responsibilities that most commercial broadcasters I've dealt with see in their role. If you go back to the original Communications Act, the assumption was that the airwaves, the ether, belonged to someone and belonged to the people in general as a resource to be held in trust for all. And I think the questions now concerning social responsibility of broadcasters come into more serious consideration because there's a change, a feeling now that somehow the property rights in the air or in the ether can be bought and sold, traded in the same way that we disposed of our early land resources.
You think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it depends on where you choose to sit with respect to individual rights, property rights. It's a very complex and complicated question. Personally, I think that the airwaves do belong to the people. It's a public resource, should be protected as such, and that there are obligations that go with owning a license or having a license from the FCC, and that social obligations are connected with that.
Mm-hmm. One way to talk about this, one specific way to talk about social responsibility in broadcasting would be to cite the making and the production, the distribution of documentaries. Ray Carroll has looked into that extensively. He's written about it. Is that a good way to judge social responsibility on the part of broadcasters? And what does it reveal, Ray?
Well, documentary form is just one of many forms for that aren't necessarily all that popular by comparison to more typical entertainment programs. And mm-hmm. they just happen to represent, almost as an icon, a lost leader among other kinds of programs that garner prestige and accolades, but don't necessarily gather the largest audience that a broadcaster would want. And I think you can look at that as whose responsibilities are being addressed. First of all, a broadcaster, whether public or commercial, has a responsibility to a board of directors. In the case of commercial broadcasters or networks, that board of directors represents investors, and people invest in order to receive a monetary return. So not too many loss leader programs are going to be presented because they will represent a minimal return rather than a maximum return. So somewhere in that is a rather delicate balance mm-hmm. between responsibility to, as Dr. Stanton pointed out, to try to present innovations or to present some kind of programming to the public that goes beyond simply entertainment or recreational values, and the responsibility to the stockholders to provide a return.
Frank Stanton?
One of the things I think that's been a sad event for American industry, let alone broadcasting, and this to a certain extent goes for public television too, is the 13-week cycle. Mm-hmm. Each quarter, somebody wants to have a better profit statement or a better performance statement than the quarter before or the comparable period a year ago. That takes out long-range planning, and it takes out the kind of commitment you'll make to a point of view that you want to develop, and you can't do it in 13 weeks. I see it in Channel 13 in New York. They're looking at in terms of what the audiences were last week, and if you have a commitment to a certain kind of documentary or a certain kind of news, or for that matter, a certain kind of entertainment, you can't get a turnaround in a 13-week cycle.
Well, there are two important influences, I think, that mitigate against having the ideal so-called social responsible programming. And those are, of course, the economic that Dr. Stanton and Bruce have both mentioned, particularly in the commercial broadcasting, that a program must ultimately pay for itself, or not too many of them at least will be put on. If it doesn't attract an audience, it's not going to be the kind of programming that you will expect normally to find in the schedule. The other one, though, that's of comparable importance is the political fallout of the programming. And if a program tends to be too controversial, the latest flap that CBS is enduring, which is far from over, the General Westmoreland lawsuit over the CBS reports broadcast. There have been ample number of examples of programs that smack of controversy, and political pressure is brought directly to bear on in this case, probably more directly on the individual stations, because they are more vulnerable, because they don't have programming decisions made quite as powerfully by a central source. And the PBS broadcast Death of a Princess, or quasi-documentary form, illustrates that point very well. In the state of Alabama, industrialists who have close ties with the Arab countries put considerable pressure upon the educational television system there not to carry that program, and indeed they didn't, and this was true in other states too. So social responsibility, as you've defined it, Wayne, isn't necessarily being carried out in as full an extent as it could be. The most recent example and I think rather unfortunate one, one of the most important issues facing the country, and especially to those of us with young children, is the state of education in the United States. ABC, to its credit, devoted a full evening schedule, but in my judgment at least, as a critic of that program, they wasted an awful lot of the time with redundancies or introductions and that sort of thing, and probably that broadcast could have been adequately handled in 90 minutes much tighter and more cohesively.
Frank Stanton a moment ago mentioned lines that blur. He was talking about formats. Speaking of a blurred line, do you think that that values of entertainment dominate in news and in public affairs today? That's certainly not an original question, but it's one that continues to be asked.
Wayne, I'm afraid if I answer that, I'll show my age. My answer is affirmative. Yes, I think there is too much of the happiness touch, too much of what's on in the world of news, and there's a lot of trivial news that's reported. I think when you look at the 23 minutes on the evening news and some of the subjects that get treatment in the 17 or 18 subjects touched upon, don't deserve that attention because there are many other things that are happening that are more important. One of the diseases that I think has infected this generation or this period in television is the feeling and the expressed determination of many producers to have an illustration behind all the words. And in many times, I think that's a self-defeating goal. I think to see people dancing or to see the horrors of a particular event taking place while somebody is giving you the headline on that particular event creates a conflict in moving the information. But why do they do that? Because I think they feel that that's the way they can get more attention and in the end what every newspaper and every book publisher wants, which is more circulation. So that I would like to get back to some talking heads because I think that gets to the nub of the whole thing, which is the idea and what the man is saying.
Ray Carroll, let me ask you to talk about our topic is broadcasting and social responsibility. Do you think today's students feel keenly a sense of responsibility to their audiences, constituencies, as they move from their educations into broadcasting, whether it's public or commercial? Do they feel a sense of responsibility? Do they have a sense of the history of broadcasting? Do they understand that that there are ideals, aside from names and dates and figures, that sort of thing? How do they place themselves into the context of broadcasting?
A truly frightening thing is to go into a classroom and ask a student if he or she remembers when John Kennedy was elected president. They weren't born yet. Mm-hmm. And they have no conception of what the Kennedy years were about, the myth of Camelot and all that, and as a consequence, don't pay much attention to the fallout, the criticism that has come of Kennedy's administration since then. They have no conception of what Vietnam was about. They in 1975, when for all intents and purposes, America's involvement ended, these people were walking around as 5 or 6 year olds, or perhaps a little bit older, but nevertheless not even aware of it. And so their sense of history is shallow at best, and it's difficult when one has gone through this as a teenager or as a young college student and been more sensitive to it to try to convey this sense of urgency that these are important things to know about.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Christensen, the great problem of that, and I think it goes to the difficulty of local news reporting, is that you have so many young people moving right into jobs of very that are very important, and they have no experience, they have no background, they have no sense of history connected with what they may be doing. I began reporting on as a correspondent for a state legislature when I was 23. That today is shocking to me because I had no more idea about what was going on in that state legislature than I would about flying a spaceship to the moon. It was totally foreign, and yet the people of that state watching or listening to the radio station, the television station I was reporting for,
trusted
me, relied on my information, and had I not had a 55-year-old cameraman whose father had been a county surveyor and learned his way and taught me all of the things that were necessary to know about what was going on. He simply led me around. He told me who was important, who needed to be interviewed. We talked about the issues, and that was the kind of training that I got. It wasn't that my news director didn't care or wasn't well trained, because I worked for one of the best news organizations in the West. It was that people didn't pay a lot of attention at that point to who was doing the reporting in terms of their background. I was competent. I could read copy well. I could write well, and had enough sense to listen to somebody who knew more than I did about what needed to go on with those issues. But that's what makes the observation that Ray has made so important, because these people will be moving into jobs. They will get jobs at local stations all the way across the country, begin reporting local news, and will have just as much authority placed on their words as if they were being broadcast from New York.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first of two discussions about media and society. The topic of the program at hand is American broadcasting and social responsibility. The panelists for Soundings are three recent visitors at the National Humanities Center: Frank Stanton, Bruce Christensen, and Raymond Carroll. Frank Stanton is President Emeritus of CBS. He's also a trustee of the National Humanities Center. Bruce Christensen is President of PBS, the Public Broadcasting Service. Raymond Carroll teaches in the School of Communication at the University of Alabama. He's editor of Feedback, the publication of the Broadcast Education Association. Here is Frank Stanton.
I think that one of the shortcomings in the training in universities today for future journalists is that they're high on technique and low on content. If I were training the ideal, to use an expression that's been kicked around here before, I would insist on a person who had a liberal arts education and didn't know which end of a studio to go in as far as broadcasting was concerned. And education is at the heart of it, and I feel very, very discouraged when I see the people who come in to see me, the grandchildren of former friends, who say, "Will you look at so-and-so who's just getting out of school and wants to be an anchorman?" And I look at the qualifications for what he's done and his marks, as well as his scholastic record of balance in liberal arts, is woefully weak. And that concerns me very deeply.
Frank Stanton, Bruce Christensen, Ray Carroll, our topic is broadcasting and social responsibility. That's pretty slippery, kind of hard to nail down. Speak to me concretely, specifically. Give me an example, a program, an individual, an idea that, to your mind, illustrates a success or a failure in the connections between broadcasting and social responsibility. Bruce Christensen, can I start with you?
On the program side, I would have to say Vietnam television history.
Now, this is the series 13?
Series, 13-part series. Took 6 years to produce. Had the help and benefit of news clips from all over the world. Stanley Carnot was the producer. And it represents, I think, from almost everybody's point of view, a reasonable examination of what happened and what went on in Vietnam. This isn't the definitive work on Vietnam. There'll continue to be additional information, new perspectives, different points of view, but at least it's a major first step towards that, and came at a time, I think, far enough after the event so that there was some reasoned perspective. The point is that it was done. It was done with care, and people seeing the series said that it was balanced. It was not, those who were hawks did not say that it gave a dovish point of view, and those who were doves did not say that it gave a hawkish point of view. But rather, all sides of that that issue, or of the issues involved in the war, were carefully explored and needed to be explored for our own good.
Ray, you've made a study of documentaries. Can you point to an example that that you think that you would hold up, for instance, to your students and say, Here's broadcasting doing something that needs to be done and doing it well? Bruce Christensen mentioned the Vietnam series.
Well, I would rather than pinpointing a specific broadcast, like to use, maybe because I've been looking at a number of these over the past couple of months, again, in most cases, the period of time when the United States was involved in the Vietnam War. I think this illustrates pretty well an instance when television news rose to the occasion, and as early as 1948, and more precisely and specifically in 1954, there were programs on the air in which warnings were provided, very specific and very clear, about the implications to American government, to the American public, if we continued to pursue an active course in what was known then as Indochina and later South Vietnam. But I was struck with the fact that there were a number of documentaries that very clearly laid out the problems and very clearly warned viewers, if they chose to watch them, here is what is going on, here are the frustrations, the muddlement, and here's what's likely to happen if we continue. And indeed, they all proved to be correct in hindsight. So I would say when crises occur, television has risen to the occasion of providing as much information as possible, and I think in a pretty accurate way.
Frank Stanton, let me ask you to consider that question of a high or a low point in your experience at CBS, addressing a social issue, meeting a social need. Let's talk about, for instance, a decision that a programming executive will make in terms of doing a news program or a public affairs program to meet a perceived or real social need, as opposed to a choice that he or she may have to put on an entertainment program.
Wayne, it doesn't come out of the real world.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't the way programs come about. No one sits on high and perceives a need and then sets about going to the program department and saying, do something on this particular subject. It just doesn't happen that way.
Well, and this is Bruce Christensen, it's their perception of what the need is. I mean, I think Harvest of Shame came out of a perception and a need to talk about something that everyone kind of swept under the rug. The individual program decisions, as Frank has said, are made based on what's there. If a program manager can look at a superb documentary and be persuaded that there's a need in the audience to show that particular program, chances are it'll find a place in the schedule. Certainly the way it works for us.
Mm-hmm. Frank Stanton.
Another example, I think, of perhaps a perceived need, but it came from the individual. It wasn't presented to the news department or to the network by anyone on high, and that was the 1960 debate series. Mm-hmm. That came about from an individual. It didn't come about with a political party. In fact, the political parties did their best to defeat it.
The sense that I get from the comments that you've made about this very large topic of broadcasting and social responsibility, Frank Stanton, Ray Carroll, Bruce Christensen, is that it comes down to personal experience, that there aren't really that many rules, there aren't that many regulations, ground rules, outlines, standards. And I don't mean by that to imply that the industry, television journalism, rejects standards, but that it comes down to one's intuitive sense of what belongs on the air and how to get it there. Do I have that right?
I wouldn't say intuitive. I'd say it's professional integrity.
Uh-huh.
It is something you learn through partly experience, something you're taught, something you begin to appreciate yourself as you exercise judgments which allow programs to get onto the air or not.
Is this the best that we can expect, the best that we can do? Should there be rules and regulations and guidelines?
Absolutely not.
Let's conclude. I want to put an idea on the table here and invite your reflections. In the 1930s, E.B. White, the writer, said that, I'm paraphrasing him here, that television is going to be the test of the 20th century, that it's going to be either a general disturbance of the peace or it will be a great radiance in the sky. Now, that may be succumbing to the fallacy of the one alternative having to rule out the other, the either or. What do you think about that? Do you think that that television, in terms of its social responsibilities, is a nuisance or is it a radiance? Frank Stanton?
Well, I certainly think that its high points have far exceeded its low points. But with television, as with books, as with newspapers, with all other art forms, you have good and you have bad. Look at the galleries in New York City and you'll find a lot of art that will never end up in the Metropolitan. There's a lot of television that will never end up in the Museum of Broadcasting.
But now, wait, that doesn't come into people's homes. It doesn't, that sort of thing isn't in front of children day in and day out. There's not an immediacy there. You were the one who pointed out that television has a mass audience, and therefore it, to one degree or another, it will have a mass effect. Ray, Carol?
Well, the public in whichever societies, in whichever times, has had a predilection for attending public hangings or bear baitings or any number of other recreational activities that aren't apparently conducive to enlightenment and reason, but people do tend to turn to low forms of sport and amusement.
Well, are you saying that television is a sort of narcotic?
Television is a form of recreation,
mm-hmm.
and that's what people use it for. Now,
to take it seriously as a real engine of social importance is what just the wrong thing to
do. Well, it's like television is a form of recreation. Newspapers and magazines are forms of recreation. I can relax as readily reading Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report as some people relax reading People magazine or the National Enquirer. It's a matter of the function it serves for the viewer in the case of television. And I prefer news and public affairs programs, but also the more typical entertainment programs, because each in their own way is a form of recreation to me, but also each in its own way can provide enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And the two don't necessarily have to be dichotomous.
So we shouldn't see social responsibility as a monolith, as Frank Stanton has implied, but we should see it as a model, as a goal for broadcasters.
What is your obligation as a citizen? Is your obligation as a citizen any less or greater?
Mm-hmm.
Because of where you live in the country or what kind of profession you may practice?
I'd hope not.
I think the social responsibility that the broadcaster has is the responsibility of a citizen, living in a constitutional democracy and committed to those ideals. To the extent that those ideals are served, then the social responsibility is met. To the extent that they are not, whether it's a broadcaster or a garbage collector, it doesn't make any difference. The social ideas are still not met, and the obligation is the same.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first of two Soundings discussions about media and society. The topic of the conversation just concluded was American broadcasting and social responsibility. The panelists for Soundings were three recent visitors at the National Humanities Center: Frank Stanton of CBS, Bruce Christensen of the Public Broadcasting Service, and Raymond Carroll of the School of Communication at the University of Alabama. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the future of cinema and cinema studies. The panelists will be John Kuiper, director of the Department of Film at the International Museum of Photography in Rochester, New York; Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill; and Russell Merritt of the University of Wisconsin. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.